Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling Biru. Did you know that women's and girls' participation in archery doubled after the Hunger Games came out, and that manga helped lift the Japanese economy in the 80s? I'm really excited to welcome my guest this week. It's Pulitzer Prize-winning author and data expert Walt Hickey. Walt's written a book about the power of pop culture and entertainment, something I come back to so often on this show. In his new book, You Are What You Watch, Walt shows the power of entertainment on our bodies, on global economy, on geopolitics, and much more. Things like we actually breathe differently when we're watching a movie in a theater. He talks about the Pentagon's involvement in Top Gun and other films, how nations gain power through popular culture, and much more. There is so much to talk about. Let's dive right in. Walt Hickey, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. This is a ton of fun.
And thank you for your book, You Are What You Watch. I'm so happy to talk to you about it because many of the themes that you have in your book, during my career as a journalist covering and discovering, these are the themes that I've been talking about. Also, Now pop culture, as you write yourself, can often be seen as a waste or a boogeyman. But if you really look at that blockbuster movie or TV show you're watching, you'll see sort of the direction the popular consciousness is in, politics, and how people are feeling. And it's so interesting. And I want to cover some of the central themes in your book.
Yeah.
I wanted to start on a personal level. You write that people often have a movie that changes your life. My longtime listeners will know that for me, it was E.T. As someone who's a bit rootless as I was, that had a lot of meaning and has carried me through. For you, it was Jurassic Park. We're both in the Spielberg. But tell me why.
Yeah, this is such a good question. And I'm so glad that you brought up earlier that this has kind of come up in your work as well, that you kind of keep running into this, that it is just it's a story that, you know, as a pop culture writer, I kept on feeling like I was writing around for a while. It always kind of felt like this was a thing that I would interview people and they were like, oh, yeah, you know, and then I saw that movie, you know, I watched ER and then Grey's Anatomy, and I realized I want to be a doctor, and I realized that women could be doctors. And then you kept on kind of seeing it over the course of just kind of idly seeing it. So that was like the motivation for doing the book. And as I kind of like tore into my own life on that, I think the Jurassic Park example that I gave is so, again, like, you know, lots of people were inspired by Jurassic Park. There's actually a chunk in the book about Jurassic Park and what it did for the field of paleontology. I am not a paleontologist, to be clear. I majored in math in college, did applied math and concentrated in on probability statistics, that kind of stuff. But I kind of come back to, you know, the presentation of Ian Malcolm as this, you know, suave, interesting, cool guy who went out into the world and did interesting and fascinating things and, you know, was able to kind of have this fun character.
And Jeff Goldblum.
Exactly. And so like just seeing that as a math, like that guy's a mathematician, I was like, you know, this isn't just, you know, chalk in classrooms. This isn't just, you know, having a knack for trig. It's, you know, you can actually be interesting and do cool, interesting stuff with it. Now, obviously, the true world of you know, studying math is mildly different than the experience that Mr. Goldblum presented on film. But I think that it did kind of give me an opportunity to think about, you know, what I really wanted out of this, why I thought that this was a cool thing, kind of follow through on an interest and a talent of mine that I otherwise maybe would have neglected just because I didn't necessarily have a role model like for you know, my family, I'm the first, you know, person to go to college to study math in my family, as it were. So then, you know, obviously integrating that into journalism later on and doing data journalism, you know, you're always kind of standing on the shoulders of giants of this stuff. But one of the giants is definitely Jurassic Park for me.
And as you're mentioning, you have both culture and math. I certainly don't have the math part. But how, explain to the listeners how you sort of incorporate those two things in not just this book, but in other work that you do as well.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And again, I think that like there's been a revolution in the past couple of years. I've kind of had a very good front row seat, I will confess, in data being applied towards journalism in new and compelling ways. And for me, I know one of the guys that was very central to this is Nate Silver. Very early on, even when I was in college, I was reading his work, which was one of the first to really kind of take a serious analytical look towards polls and what we ought to draw conclusion wise from them versus the traditional way of doing politics reporting, which was very access based, very embedded, very let's listen to what the campaigns are telling us and write it up a little bit. And so he was able to kind of challenge some of the initial prevailing wisdom on how we were able to kind of report on elections and things like that. And that was a really fascinating thing to watch. I eventually got to work for the guy, and he gave me the opportunity to cover lifestyle and culture, which is kind of a fun remit, just because, like, you know, there's been a lot of pop culture coverage for economics because we have an entire department of the government that produces statistics about economics. We call it the Department of Labor. There's been a lot of like statistics when it comes to sports. We've seen things like Moneyball. We've seen the sports revolution. We've seen basically how can we find out new and cool things about this thing that we love by applying numerical analysis to it, right? Nate's done a ton of good stuff when it comes to really kind of building out the field of politics and numbers. But pop culture was kind of a bit new territory. Nobody had really kind of really just gone towards it and really applied having their entire beat be the intersection of pop culture and data. And so I had the chance to do that while working for him. And basically it was a chance to like, how do we really kind of take some of these techniques and understanding these kind of information that is just out there and find a way to talk about it and kind of find new stories that we otherwise would not have been able to do, you know?
Yeah. I thought we'd start with the body, our bodies, because you can answer why horror movies make our blood curdle.
Yeah.
There's actually a physical reaction that you can see. Talk about that.
Yeah, I you know, loved working on that chapter in particular, but just because I got to talk to some extremely interesting people. The fun thing about reporting this book out was that like I started out doing like a really massive literature review, figuring out what science had been done on this, basically figuring out like as a journalist, who should I phone up and try to have a conversation with. And in chapter one, I talked to there's a couple stories in chapter one, and they basically all revolve around how pop culture experiences can actually physically manifest within our body. And actually, you know, we can observe changes and we can observe, you know, like a specific things that occur. And the best part about this was that the scientists that I interview in the chapter, they're not like media scientists. Like one of the guys studies VOCs, volatile organic compounds, basically looks at how organic life, what we kind of shed off when it comes to chemistry, which gives us insight into how biological systems are working. And this guy spends a lot of his year in the Amazon because basically looking at what rainforests exhale, so to speak. And then another fellow that I talked to is basically, he's a researcher that studies, he's a medical researcher, physician, and he studies thrombosis, which is basically the clotting system within the blood. And, you know, his primary focus at his day job is strokes. You want to avoid the body clotting when it ought not to, which can lead to some serious problems. And also in the other direction, you want it to clot when it needs to, which leads to a different set of problems if you don't. And so, you know, I was talking to these guys and both of these have done very cool studies that used pop culture to advance their scientific goals. One of them basically strapped up the same device that he uses to analyze the air composition of the rainforest to a movie theater and then analyzed what happened to people's breath during a movie and found not only do we see repeatable spikes in chemicals that the humans in the theater exhaled, which kind of gives us an insight into what's going on within their bodies, but there are all sorts of different ways that we don't even understand what these films are doing to us because they're causing repeatable spikes in chemicals that we don't know what they do. The other question that you asked about, like what's going on when your blood curdles. You know, the guy who studies the coagulation system basically took blood samples before and after showing people a horror movie and showing people a very neutral movie, a documentary about wine, and essentially found that over the course of a horror movie, your body is preparing itself to bleed. There's a coagulation factor that when you watch something on screen that terrifies you and thinks, you know, your brain takes it very, very seriously. Your brain is acting as if you yourself may be injured by the movie that you're watching. And as a result, there's a physical manifestation of that throughout your bloodstream.
You're actually having physical manifestations that you can see.
Yeah, it was funny. Like, it's like the gentleman who orchestrated that study about clotting. He's European, I believe. The university's out of the Netherlands, and they came up with this because, you know, they have a very polyglot academic world out there, and they kind of realized that, well, it's kind of weird that English and Dutch and French all have a word that means blood curdling. Like, it's weird that curdling, like the act of becoming solid from liquid, is specifically an element of our languages. We should try to get to the bottom of that. Why is that? Like, does blood curdle when you get spooked? Like,
this is, I guess, less surprising that pop culture will inspire people. Like, I have relatives who went to see the castle from Downton Abbey, and we ate lunch where Succession filmed in Tuscany and things like that. And you'll see a rise of, yeah, but it's easy to find.
That sounds genuinely fun, though. Please send me
the beats. Yeah, it was awesome. What surprised you most on that direct correlation between what people are seeing and rise in popularity of?
Yeah, there's you'd always kind of known that pop culture will affect things, right? And like the tourism thing that you shouted out is great. I have a big map in the book that's all basically different locations and what happened to them after a film came out. Everything from Iowa after Field of Dreams to, as you mentioned, Downton Abbey. There's a big chunk of the book that's basically about after The Lord of the Rings comes out. It is phenomenal what happens to tourism to New Zealand. And you can kind of really see a fairly direct relationship. The ones that I always come back to when I'm having this conversation are, it is just so wild to me how big and pronounced some of these spikes are. And I'm thinking of two things in particular. One is, there's a chart book about dog breeds, and after a film comes out, what happens to registrations with the American Kennel Club for these dog breeds. And the other one that I'm thinking of is baby names. And with the dog breeds one, it is just remarkable that Dalmatians went from, I think, like high 40s or something like that. And then 101 Dalmatians gets re-released in the early 90s. And then they become like the seventh or eighth most popular dog in America. And like, if you actually seriously kind of contemplate that for a second, it is wild. Like, this is, we're talking hundreds of thousands of animals here. And there are hundreds of thousands of animals who are dogs who have never seen this film, whose lives were fundamentally changed by the re-release of a cartoon by the Walt Disney Company. And as like, families got a different dog as a result of it. Like, and it's just so, like, if you contemplate the implications of this kind of stuff, it's wild. I keep on coming back to the baby names one too, which is just funny because it's like, man, there are a whole lot of Aryas from Game of Thrones, and now that the millennials are having kids, there's a whole lot of Lunas. From Luna Lovegood from Harry Potter that are walking around in the world right now. And you had seen the name spike after Twilight, which was always very interesting, but now you're really seeing, like, Arya has become a very common name. There's going to be a lot of, like, you know, I don't know if we're going to see a lot of Khaleesi's in any kind of clip.
How about Wednesdays? We're going to see a lot of Wednesdays.
We might. That's the thing. Like, how many billions of watch hours did that thing have? Like,
that's like the biggest.
Know, you got to give it a couple years, but again, the goth kids are marrying up. I don't know what to tell you. Like...
<Hey. laughs> I want to talk to you about something that, I mean, a lot of people talk about. That's the relationship between pop culture and crime, which you have very interesting chapters on in your book. Talk a little bit about what you found in your studies.
Yeah, so this is like a really good question that obviously when you set out to write a book like this, you do kind of want to write about how do we address either the negative externalities or there's this, you know, oftentimes I think it's a bit of a boogeyman of like movies, like, oh, people cause violence as a result of movies. And that had always kind of given me a little bit of pause just because, you know, the counter argument for me from like, do violent movies cause violent crimes? Do movies involving shooters cause violent shootings? Things like that. Is that like every country in the world has these movies. The United States is an exporter. Everything that we see, the rest of the world sees for all intents and purposes. There are obviously some exceptions. There are obviously some countries that where this kind of stuff doesn't do well. But, you know, for the world, like in any given country, you have your domestic film industry and then you have the American film industry. And as a result, you see what we see. And you don't see the kinds of, like, you know, mass shooting events that happen in other countries, but they have video games too, and they have online gaming too. And several countries spend far more time watching movies and playing video games than we do. And so it was always a kind of a troubling idea that, like, these things are kind of causing or inspiring that. And so, when I was doing the research on this kind of stuff, you do kind of want to look into what is the effect that this kind of stuff has in the aggregate, because in a lab setting, it is absolutely true that if you show somebody a piece of violent film, if you show somebody violent imagery, if you show somebody images of violence or ideas of violence, and then in a laboratory setting, you ask them to make decisions that are, you know, primed that one is perhaps a more violent decision than the other, you'll find that oftentimes people who saw more violent content are more likely to behave slightly more violently in a laboratory. And that had always kind of been a bit of a sticking point, because obviously we know that people potentially get a little bit more agitated after you make them agitated. The question is, does this actually have an impact societally? And the chapter that I kind of like go into this on, there's a kind of a bigger theme in it, which is that one of the most powerful things about pop culture and just the things that we watch are that we spend a lot of time doing it. That we are watching things as an alternative to doing other things. And so, you know, a lot of times this can be framed as like, well, you know, you want to watch a movie instead of volunteering at a soup shelter. And that's so why are you wasting your time with movies and that kind of stuff? But at the same time, they can also be pretty big distractions for pretty good things. So like, if you looked at like the kind of your standard case of what a movie can be doing, specifically a violent film, there was this terrific study done by two economists that looked at the release of films, violent and otherwise, over the course of a couple of years. And then they looked at crime statistics, specifically violent crimes, specifically assaults from those same periods. And what they found was really at first so shocking to them, which was that on the nights that violent films were released, these assaults went down. There was a statistically significant decrease in the number of assaults that happened when you release violent films. And they went into the study expecting quite the opposite. They expected to be able
is
to kind
because
of
because all the violent people were watching the movie?
Yes. I mean, that's 100% it. I mean, like, if you think about, like, people who are prone to being violent, and, like, when I say people who are prone to violent, I genuinely just kind of mean men between the ages of 16 and 24. That's a time in people's lives when testosterone does complicated things to their body. And if you look at violent crime, it's 16 to 24 is that window. And so a lot of public health programs related to mitigating crime are actually just related to how do we get people who are ages 16 to 24 in a safe space. That's why you see midnight basketball become a thing. That's why you see church youth groups tend to kind of focus on Fridays and things like that. It's literally a public health strategy in order to ensure that people are doing something productive rather than doing something non-productive. And with a violent film, like, you know, you can get people who normally and ordinarily might be out in a bar or just going out for a night and staying out late and drinking and that kind of stuff. And instead, they're spending 2 to 3 hours of the evening sequestered in a chilly, nice, safe room watching something that they're not drinking, like, real whiskey. They're drinking, you know, a Pepsi from the concession stand. And what they found that was really interesting is, number one, simply by this self-sequestration effect, the fact that people were who ordinarily might be in a bar or out on the street, they were in a movie theater instead. They found that this, you know, mitigated the opportunities for people to basically injure or themselves or others. But then the biggest thing was later on in the night that, you know, we talked about how, you know, lots of this kind of crime is modulated by young men. The other thing that it's super modulated by is alcohol. And so as a result, if instead of drinking for 3 hours and getting up to a BAC of, you know, 0.6 or 0.7, somebody starts at zero and then still goes to a bar after, they're going to finish the night less drunk than they were if they had gone to the bar instead. And so as a result, what they found is that not only is there a decrease during the film, there's also a decrease after the film, which kind of countermands that laboratory idea of, like, after you show somebody something violent, they behave more violently. Whatever effect that actually manifests as, it is drowned out by the idea that instead of going to a bar or doing something else or spending an evening doing something that might get them in trouble, they spend at least 3 hours of that somewhere nice and safe just watching a violent movie.
What about sort of the concept of becoming desensitized that people talk a lot about, just seeing a lot of violence and or playing violent games and things like that, the accumulation of that?
Yeah, the accumulative effect is hard to quantify. And that's kind of where we have to go back to the broader global picture, which is that, you know, other countries have exposure to the same kind of long-term exposure to violent media. The question is, does that kind of get people to do stuff is a very difficult question to address with science, because you would have to basically set up a controlled experiment that is pretty unethical in that, what if you showed one group of people violent films once a
sort
week?
Sort of the Kubrick method with the...
So that's a little bit beyond our expertise, is based on the conversations that I had with some of these folks, what I was hearing. So I don't have too much on that. But again, like, I think, you know, the results from a public health perspective kind of speak for themselves, which again is, if you can get a guy past the age of 26, they're probably not going to do any additional crimes. Like, that's tends to be like that. That is the window that you need to really kind of get people through, is what some of the criminologists that I spoke to described it as. And so, like, over the course of people's lives, as they mature, and as, you know, things get a little bit less rigorous when it comes to hormones, that is, I think, the thing that people should kind of keep in mind, which is that, like, you know, obviously movies and television will change your attitudes over time, and so you should be cognizant of potentially what you consume when it comes to that regard. But I think, like, you know, outright condemning the idea of violent or racy media actually kind of misses the forest for the trees in some regards, particularly when it comes to how we deal with young men and you know, what they want to say.
But in terms of, like, influences, like people taking cues from gangster movies and things like that,
I mean, the thing about that, though, is that, like, I don't know if the mafia necessarily saw a spike in applications after Goodfellas came out. Like, you know, the other one that I talk about that is, I think, germane to this is heist movies.
Right.
And, like, heist movies, like, nobody's robbed a casino after, like, seeing Ocean's 11. They thought about it for a little bit, but, like, it isn't necessarily, like, what people's first instinct is. You know, a lot of these movies are about, they use the conversation of crime to propel another idea, or talk about, you know, what it means to work, or what it means to do a job together, or what it means to successfully pull something off. So, yeah.
Moving on to even a bigger, the geopolitics, the global scale here. You have some very interesting examples about how countries used pop culture to accumulate power, even. Give me one of those examples.
Yeah, I mean, so there's three in the book that I talk about, and as I, you know, bring up the three, I'll pick which one's my favorite. So the United States, as kind of the baseline for this, is obviously how the United States became the center of a lot of this is an interesting story. But there's three countries in particular that I think used their pop cultural exports to really kind of adjust their place in the geopolitical pecking order in a way that you used to have to use battleships and hard power. And that is the United Kingdom, particularly after World War II, as their place was shifting throughout the global order, and they went from being the largest colonial power to a, you know, a European power, and how one modulates that. And then there's Japan, which really, I think, is kind of reaping what it's sown when it comes to its pop culture exports now. Has seen just a surge in interest and a surge in demand for, you know, not only Japanese content, not only for animation, but also just for tourism in general to go there. Even after the pandemic, it's rebounded to a remarkable level. And then the third one is Korea, which is kind of, you know, following that model and is a little bit more in the beginning of it than the other ones are kind of more matured with it. And I guess I will talk about Japan just because I think it is one that is really kind of reaping, like, again, you know, Japan after World War II in particular really kind of turned inward a lot, and their media was developing in kind of a different way than a lot of other countries' media were, just because of the way that, you know, the post-war order was coming together. And particularly as you kind of saw the development of their animation industry, you saw some low-key cross-cultural occurrence. A lot of one of the researchers who I spoke to, who's an expert on this, was like, yeah, like, anime started coming to the States because, you know, the United States had a military base in Okinawa that had, you know, a couple hundred thousand people on it, if not more at times. And these people would bring their kids, and then their kids would get exposed to it. They would bring it back to the States. And then, like, so there was, like, a low-key interest in anime fandom that kind of started growing during the 60s and 70s. Eventually, they started, like, it became very cheap to license that kind of stuff and exhibited on American televisions. That's why you got things like Astro Boy. That's why you got things Like basically some modest exposure to Japanese content, but there was no dedicated export strategy, in no small part because Japan's relations with its neighbors weren't particularly sparkling during that era. The Second World War really diminished, you know, the Japanese standing in the particular the Southeast Asian community. And then it just kind of became a steady drumbeat, though. And again, I feel like when I was growing up, like, you even had things like Toonami, which were pretty unambiguously designed to let's import stuff from Japan that we think is interesting. And so it wasn't really until the 90s that they realized, like, we have a lot of really compelling pop culture here and people tend to like it. We should try to develop a strategy to, you know, help facilitate its translation and export. And so it kind of started then, but it really wasn't until Pokemon really swept the world that all of a sudden this became a genuine phenomenon. That was people's on-ramp to a lot of things. Nintendo had always kind of had a robust relationship, but again, with Pokemon, it kind of genuinely showed a side of Japan that people hadn't necessarily seen before. And that just kind of gave an explosion of interest. And so since the 2000s, you know, in part because of this government strategy to try to incentivize people to export their content, in part because of, you know, even just events like, you know, Miyazaki winning Best Picture for Spirited Away, even just through things like, you know, Pokemon kind of continued to persevere and that kind of thing, as well as just now an increased license to export content and export, like, really, like, they're no longer holding back, has also kind of allowed them to kind of export the production elements to other countries too. And so as a result, you've been able to see some top flight anime studios in creating offices to help design and do some early animation in plenty of other Southeast Asian countries that has also helped develop their domestic animation industry. And as a result, you know, it's one of these situations in which, you know, if you invest in these kind of places and you invest in this kind of talent, that's also how you can get some homegrown and interesting talent and that kind of too, which has sparked, you know, excellent animation and illustration businesses throughout the Philippines and throughout the rest of Southeast Asia.
There must be some danger in talking about government manipulation of pop culture. I mean, going that far, what have you seen there?
Oh yeah, I mean, so again, with Japan, like, the government really did keep hands off. There was a moment in the 90s when they were like,
Japan, I mean, yeah, in general.
You know, a lot can happen in 7 minutes, and luckily that's how long it takes me to tell a story. My name is Aaron Calafato, and I'm the creator of 7 Minute Stories. I'm proud to partner with Evergreen Podcasts, and I'd like to invite you to join me on this journey. I'm going to take you on some crazy roller coaster rides using my unique extemporaneous storytelling style, and together, we're going to try to make sense of the world, all through the art of storytelling, and all in approximately 7 minutes.
No, because I think that they kind of saw what happens when your government is the only one that is subsidizing this kind of stuff. I think that can cause some issues. There's like a lot of, like, the U.S. government has had a somewhat torrid relationship with Hollywood, like during World War II, kind of took it over and turned it into a propaganda pipeline. Like the studio heads were liaising pretty directly with the federal government and a lot of this kind of stuff. Walt Disney Animation was creating films that were teaching soldiers how to get into parachutes and whatnot. And, you know, it can be a bit of an uneasy relationship, particularly in the United States. The federal government's been a little bit hands off when it comes to the management of the industry, but this hasn't been the case in a lot of other countries. In Europe in particular, most of their domestic film industry tends to be kind of government funded. This can kind of affect what gets made and what doesn't get made. This can kind of affect who gets to make stuff and who doesn't get to make stuff. You know, I wrote a little bit about the United Kingdom, but the United Kingdom has had, you know, one of the things that really provoked a bit of a renaissance when it came to their ability to export art and artists was that they had state-funded art schools and they had state-funded acting schools and they had a great deal of state funding for the kind of mechanisms that actors are trained. And a lot of that dried up. And so when the government kind of pulled out of that, all of a sudden you went from seeing a lot of actors who were very working class people, maybe people who didn't necessarily either go to college, or if they did go to college, they trained specifically for acting or they came from working class backgrounds. And those people started to have a lot more difficulty breaking into the industry. It went very much from, you know, you can have the first guy to come to mind is a guy like Michael Caine, who's notoriously, you know, comes from a working class background, was able to buy his mama house because of his appearance in Jaws 4. And then, you know, now it becomes a little bit more of a posh career. And so, you know, the government's ability to kind of steer this stuff is definitely interesting. And we're kind of seeing some of that in Korea now, because the Korean government has taken a very active role in the promotion and export of its pop culture. Part of the thing with Korea is that Korea, the economy is dominated by a number of small family controlled conglomerates, essentially, that have a very easygoing relationship with the government. So it's one of those situations in which it is kind of, you know, their economy all rowing in the same direction when it comes to that. But it is like, it is an interesting question of how much you can actually have the government step in to pick winners and losers with pop culture versus what are the kind of things that kind of succeeds on their own merits.
What would you say is the relationship with the U.S. government today with popular culture? I mean, not just necessarily what they're doing with studios, but like, are they using pop culture in different ways and campaigns and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I like this. I don't write about this a ton in the book because I'm not super like interested in like the campaign element. But like, I do think it is wild how integrated actors have become into the national political campaigning apparatus. It is just weird to me. Like, I covered the 2016 election, and like a moment that is indelibly seared into my head is an a cappella version of the song Fight Song that involves half of the cast of Pitch Perfect and whatnot. And it was just like, I don't really know what's happening here anymore. In terms of the actual government, there are a couple of very specific examples. The biggest one is the military. The military has had a very increasingly positive relationship with Hollywood. Basically, it's had a, like, you know, the army's been involved in making movies since The Wings in 1927. They've always had a very big role to play when it comes to lending, you know, props and material towards the advancement of movies that they think advance their interests. You know, planes, ships, they cost a lot of money. And Paramount has a lot of money, but they don't have that much money. And so as a result, for a while, the Army had a pretty easygoing relationship with the movie industry, in no small part because, you know, the World War II experience in which they kind of became one and one. There was a film called The Longest Day that basically detailed the D-Day landings that became a gigantic political firestorm because the Army lent a lot of material to the producers of that film, did not have any authority over the final cut of the film. And when the film came out, Congress was like, number one, why the hell did you spend all this money helping to make this movie happen? And number two, like, some of this doesn't look great for us. I don't know why we did this. And so they kind of like slammed the brakes on military intervention in Hollywood and basically offering resources. And that continued for a couple decades. During Vietnam, like, the relationship between Hollywood and the Pentagon was terrible. Like, the Pentagon did not like a lot of the movies that were coming out about Vietnam. They weren't supporting the movies that were coming out about Vietnam financially or with any resources. If they shot a movie about Vietnam, they were shooting it with all of the studio's money and no resources from the Pentagon. Then in the 80s, the film happens that's called Top Gun. And Top Gun is an utter reset button. It completely resets the relationship between the film industry and the Pentagon. And it starts off as basically, how do we support this film that we think, like, they had script approval. They had the ability to kind of go through, here's what we like about this. They were able to weigh in on some of the plot points, which I'll get to in a second. They offered millions of dollars worth of man hours and material that Paramount did pay for, but they paid for a cost. It wasn't they like, if you were trying to field this army on your own, it would be a little bit more than what Paramount paid the feds. My favorite note from the research on this was given to me by a researcher who specializes in this topic with the military's intersection with Hollywood. And so you can check it out in the book, but basically the extent of it is, like, there's a memo, and it's a typed out memo, and it's basically being like, hey, so I read the script. It's from the Korea desk at the Pentagon, so the people who are in charge of the relationship in the Koreas. And it was like, hey, read the script for Top Gun. Love this stuff. Here's the thing. We don't want North Korea to be the bad guy. We don't want that to kind of set stuff off. It would be great. I mean, like, do you guys just want to make it Libya? Do you want to make the bad guy Gaddafi? That could be fine, right? And then hand scrawled on the physical typed out letter is a note from the Libya desk being like, we don't want to give Gaddafi any ideas, just please make it an unnamed country. And you can literally see this like script change in real time, and you don't know who the enemy, quote unquote, is in Top Gun, because they just fly MiGs. They fly the baddie planes, and they don't, but like, specifically the federal government had to weigh in and be like, we really don't want to give like Kim or Gaddafi, any ideas, please chill out. Don't do this. And so you can just kind of see them, that sparked so much just because, you know, on one hand, like they got to weigh in on their script. They got the things that they wanted. They extracted the things that they got. Tom Cruise's relationship with that in the film is not with a fellow officer or a subordinate. It's with a contractor. And that is a thing that the government would like to have seen. Mm-hmm. And so since then, Hollywood kind of realized, like, holy crap, this is a bargain. We can get tanks, we can get armies. We don't need to pay armies of extras. We can just get extras to hang it on the tarmac. And so there's been a huge collaboration between Hollywood and the Pentagon since. Now, taking a step back, is that a good thing? Is it good that Hollywood's voluntarily censoring the kind of content that they're putting out just so that they can get some more tanks in the backing shot? Or is it good that Hollywood is making these decisions? I think it comes down on a case-by-case basis. I think that there's movies that don't have to change all that much in order to get this kind of material, and then there's movies that do change a lot, and there's movies that don't get supported, and then there's movies that become financially less viable because there's no, like, if you're doing something sufficiently critical of the military-industrial complex, that they're not going to help you. And so, you know, I could talk about this particular topic all day because it is fascinating. There's a chart that I really love in the book that kind of details how the Pentagon evaluated submissions for various different films. And it gives you like, yeah, I mean, Independence Day, I mean, it seemed kind of silly. There was no aliens. And obviously the U.S. was caught flat-footed. So we don't want to put that. We're not going to support that. Like,
do you know the same story with Maverick?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, yeah. I don't have the documents yet, but like, you can always tell. And this is very fun. So if you watch a movie and you watch the credits and you get all the way through the credits, you'll see special thanks to. And in special thanks to, you will understand, did the military support this or not? Because if they do, it'll like thank each division, thank each commander. It used to thank a guy named Phil Strub, who was in charge of that relationship. He was the liaison to Hollywood from the Pentagon. It will basically tell you, like, we want to thank the dedicated crew of the USS Abraham Lincoln. We want to and so, like, for Top Gun, we have the receipts. We literally know, here's how many flight hours they had, here's how many planes they had, here's how many cameras they had, here's what equipment they lost in the course of shooting Top Gun. Those are very cool documents that I was very, very excited to see. For a lot of these, we don't actually know what these documents look like. There's some hardworking journalists who are doing some very cool FOIAs on it. And it is basically a little bit of an enigma, but you'll notice there's no enemy named in Top Gun Maverick. We're fighting North Korea. It is the enemy's got fifth generation fighters. I don't know. That's it. That's the
problem.
And
there's a mountain range and they're going through it.
Yes. So yeah. What countries have fifth generation fighters and mountains? The answer is only the United States. But nevertheless, it is very, it is like, you know, I really dig that movie. I'm not going to lie. But it is.
But obviously, going back to what we were talking before, what effect does it have on the audiences, the movies that are heavily supported by the military and the ones that aren't?
I mean, that's the thing. Like, the reason that the military does this is two things. Like I mentioned, the history of movies and the military is, for a while, they supported them, and then they realized that they weren't getting the best deal out of Hollywood. And then Vietnam, that era, nobody wanted to collaborate. Like, there was no East Coast, West Coast collaboration. There were no flights between Dulles and LAX. And then all of a sudden Top Gun comes out and resets that relationship, because immediately after, the Navy sees a huge spike in interest to people who want to work in the Navy. And the Air Force does too, which is kind of funny because the Navy was very mad about that. They were very, very unhappy that the Air Force got a little bit of the juice, because it is a Navy air, rather, like, you know, the Navy's got the second largest Air Force in the world. But nevertheless, Navy got a big spike. They enjoyed that, but also they got a little bit of a halo, you know, that they got a little bit of a, like, we can start winning wars. So we'll just do it on the screen rather than, you know, having to kind of try to sell people on Vietnam. And so as a result, since then, you've seen tons of these, you know, movies receive a ton of support. One of my favorites that, again, so the researcher who I spoke to for a lot of this is this guy, Tom Secker. He's a genius, and he has obtained so many cool documents to kind of advance this work. He also has a book that kind of delves entirely into this, which I totally recommend. He also did a recent work, I believe, on superheroes and the military-industrial complex, and basically detailing the relationship between Marvel Studios and the military, and some really cool stuff in there, I'm not going to lie. And so one thing that he was telling me is, like, think of a movie like Black Hawk Down. Black Hawk Down, the Somali expedition, where we lost several American lives over the course of this mission, was a failure. Their mission did not succeed. They did not get the outcome that they wanted to get. They lost Americans. This was at the time a big embarrassment, right? And like in the press and in the news and at the time, like this was a black guy. Black Hawk Down reframes that story as a heroic rescue. And if you ask your typical American now, what did you think of the war in Somalia? They're like, Black Hawk Down, where we saved those guys. It allows them to kind of reframe either military failures or military mistakes as, you know, glorious, valiant, as well as, you know, which takes the heat off the brass, the guys who actually order this kind of thing. And it also has a recruitment element to it, because obviously if you ask folks, you know, like, you can ask people like, do you want to fly planes or do you want to go to space? And, you know, on one hand, they'll say, you know, sure, academically. But then if you show them what it's like to fly a plane in a movie, or if you show them what it's like to go to space in a movie, that can really check a few boxes. And so there's, you know, just the general PR effect where finally we're watching movies where the American military is winning wars and kicking the sufficient amount of ass, where we're potentially reframing events to really kind of dignify and glorify the perspective of the United States on them. And and lastly,
you
we
see
are
a danger in that.
Oh, totally. I don't think that's good. I think that
because it's,
you know,
not the same as wanting to be a math, going to math for Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, I mean, so again, like, I have a ton of respect for the military and the people who serve in it. I covered the military in the past, and like, again, like, this is an organization that does do a lot of global good. I think that they're just like, the way that the American media is structured right now is that there is not like the media counterweight that sufficiently invested, like, again, like the one of the big things that the military tries to keep out of movies is that if there's any references to sexual harassment or sexual assault of service members, particularly female service members, within a script, they do not support that. And it's either got to change or it's got to go. And they didn't support G.I. Jane for this reason. The Ridley Scott film, they yanked all funding. And so they had to shoot, I believe, at a college dorm. And as a result, that's a serious issue. That is one of the most serious issues in the military. If you look at the perception right now among, like, you know, women are actually about 16% of the American military right about now. And that number is going up. And one of the biggest concerns that they have is that there is a very high prevalence of sexual assault within the military. And you can't just cover that up by not showing it in films. Like, they have to address that. And to their credit, they're taking it seriously. They're taking it increasingly seriously than they were a decade ago. And they're making changes about it. But like, as a journalist, it just gives me pause that like, we are seeing a deliberately misframed perspective on the United States military because they don't want people talking about that. The other two things that they don't want is they don't want significant demonstrations of PTSD, and they don't want representations of people taking their own lives. And these are facts of life, unfortunately, of what the United, what it kind of comes in the wake of this. And so the picture that they're painting is a little bit distorted. And I think that if it's the only picture, that's a terrible thing. That really is. I think that it is on the rest of the media, particularly the nonfiction media, to make sure that we're filling in those gaps. But, the issue that we kind of get here is that the people who make these films, the five major studios, you know, these are for-profit businesses, and the courage of their convictions only goes so far. And so as a result, it can be tough to make a persuasive argument between one of the five largest media companies in the world and the Pentagon that they ought to be showing some more verisimilitude when it comes to this, you know?
I was so curious because at the start of the book, you talk about, I think it's Ebert who calls movies an empathy or a vehicle of empathy, right? Or
an empathy like machine is I believe, his words.
Yeah,
I dig it.
And I'm wondering, there's so many, I've talked so much about it on the show regarding the strikes and everything, and so much talk about AI. I was wondering what you think will there be a machine of empathy when the machines are writing the stories?
God, no, absolutely not. No, I think that, like, again, like the empathy machine thing, I think he made long before the idea that robots could actually participate in the production of films.
Yeah.
I would I think that what he was trying to get at, and the thing that I actually do really love, and I get it in a little bit of chapter 5, is that movies are actually like a piece of technology. And if you look at the economic history of the creation of films, there's this amazing book that I read. It's an academic book, so it's a little bit beefy, but it's called Entertainment Industrialized. It's by a guy named Gerben Backer. And it was just really illuminating about basically what the early days of movies were like when it came to how people were perceiving the technology at the time. Because you got to remember, movies aren't one invention, right? There are about six inventions that all kind of happen in similar time periods that make it possible to make a film. And so you had basically, a lot of them started out as like magicians would travel around and have like light show and projection shows where like you would have you know, things projected on the walls or projected through smoke, that even today, you, if you go to an amusement park, you'll sometimes see that kind of tech used. It's basically using smoke as a way to project ghosts or things like that. You saw the development of celluloid, which was originally designed for billiard balls and was not actually made into film strips for about 50 years after its invention, because again, they were just making so much damn money on these billiard balls. And so you eventually saw this plastic technology come around. You saw the ability for people to take photographs, which was a separate thing. That was a chemical reaction that basically allowed these dyes to take place. You then saw the technology for people to take fast photographs and these fast photographic dyes. And then you saw the technology for people to take sequential photographs, right? And so those were different because, again, you can have like a little like slideshow style thing that you show and you can have the illusion of motion, but you're still not at a film yet. You need to combine, how do we make these thin celluloid strips have this thing? How do we get this onto that? How do we use a projector, that light thing, to get it into a cinema? And then eventually they're able to kind of add sound, because at the time they just basically linked up pianos and that kind of thing. And then how do you do this at scale? So how do you take a negative and then put it onto as many positives as you want, which will allow you to actually distribute this? And so, you know, the invention of film, quote unquote, was took 100 years because it took a lot of different technologies happening at the same time. But when it came out, it was sensational. And, you know, Edison had a lot of the patents on it and was trying very early on to make sure that he was the only one who could produce the actual films that were happening on it. And I'll get back to that in a second. You eventually saw it get to the Europe was this bastion of innovation for it. The United States was a lot of early film production took place in places like New Jersey, which is obviously where Edison was based, and places like Florida. Like Los Angeles was not necessarily the place that all films were made. A couple things then happened. First is that World War I happens, and all of the innovation that was happening on the continent and all the investment that was happening on the continent is blown up and dies. And as all the money is spent towards rebuilding France and rebuilding Belgium and rebuilding Germany and rebuilding these areas, they no longer have any kind of competitive film industry, because film industry at the time was a very, you know, it was functionally a speculative investment. I compare it to crypto in the book, where people would come out on the New York Stock Exchange with a film and the title of their company just to try to quick pop, whether or not they were actually in it or not. And eventually what happens with LA is that there's a concentration of talent, where basically a lot of the European talent comes over. There's a lot of the money there. There's connections between both financiers, whether they're in New York or otherwise, as well as people who are shooting, you know, cheaply in Southern California. You have these guys who eventually became these studio heads out there making these films. You saw them establishing a distribution pattern and also establishing an export pattern. And from there, the only reason that Los Angeles is the center of the film industry is that Los Angeles is the place where all the talent converged. There's no film mine up in the hills that compelled people to go there. It's just, it was a nice place that really made itself into a company town. And what we consistently find time and time again throughout the history of film is that it's that concentration of talent, and it's that concentration of innovation, and it's new combinations of those people working together in interesting ways. Then that's what makes interesting films. It's not like, you know, we don't really like, you know, we have auteurs within film, right? But there, it's the most collaborative art form. One person, like, you know, you can make a short individually and you can bootstrap yourself. And that's a really cool thing that we have now when it comes to the technology. But at the end of the day, for this kind of like the product that we've become accustomed to, you'd need hundreds of people. You need thousands of people to make these kind of things happen. And there's always going to be technology that advances that kind of either distribution mechanism or advances our ability to reach new audiences. I am an AI skeptic in general, but in specific, I think that AI has a lot of potential in one specific case, which is like, how do we get films translated into languages that they can't be translated in now? And the idea of having automatic subtitles and these translation features and these adaptive listening features that are able to take films that, you know, are not financially viable to translate into English or to translate from English to another language or to translate from Spanish to French. It's a different way of basically reaching an audience that I think that is a way that technology can empower us, as it has always empowered us, whether it was the transition to digital film or the transition to, you know, different kinds of distribution of television. But getting back to what I was saying about Edison, is like when one individual had a grip on what got made and what didn't, things were not innovative. Things were not coming out that were interesting. What has always been the salvation of the industry was it's a collaborative environment between a lot of different creatives. And my view on the strikes in particular was like, listen, like, the inputs, the reason that this entire operation is successful is that you have an unprecedented concentration of talent. You have an unprecedented concentration of people who are working within this area or are willing to come to this area. Like, I don't want to say that the film industries of other countries aren't robust, because they're obviously robust, but the United States is the only place that you're going to see films that combine the inputs of other countries necessarily into a fun financial product, or rather a fun film product that can make a large financial windfall, I should say. So like with the AI stuff, I just think that like the thing that we've seen time and time again is that efficiency is actually the enemy of creativity when it comes to this kind of films. You need to have a lot of people working on a thing. You need a number of writers coming in and taking a pass on a thing. You know, it's a different medium than a novel, which a novel is one person can make. Obviously, you do need a couple other people to edit it. You need a couple other people to come in on that kind of stuff. It's naive to suggest that only one person is responsible for a book. But like, you know, that's one person's vision, very frankly. Like, but the difference is that the difference between Game of Thrones, the book, is the vision of one person, whereas Game of Thrones, the show, is the input of dozens of actors, hundreds of background actors, tons of stunt professionals, cinematographers, you know, producers, writers, to say the absolute minimum, and then showrunners and directors. And so each individual element of that has a little bit more excitement going on, just because it's actors bouncing off against actors, and it's directors bouncing off against actors, and it's cinematographers doing work that they can't do in different kinds of mediums. And so, you know, taking the back step of all this, I know that I've talked about the entire history of the film industry from an economic perspective to answer your question about AI, is that what AI can't do is the creative things that genuinely make the American industry great. I think that like, if there are places in the world that lack that kind of combustion and lack that kind of ability for people to come together and make that kind of content, perhaps AI can help them a little bit. But like, it would be the death knell for the very thing that makes this industry so vibrant and interesting if they decide to sell what is their primary, if only, competitive advantage for pennies on the dollar.
Walt, finally, going back, you said that Jurassic Park influenced you a lot. What are some of the other movies and television shows throughout your life and in important periods that you would say have really changed things for you or meant something for you?
Wow. This is such a good question. So I'm thinking, like, I'm just trying to think real quick. I would say The Wire made a very big difference on me. I think that I don't know, for, you know, I know that that's a television show, and that television shows sometimes have a lower reach than audiences, but I always felt like you know, I enjoyed McNulty a lot. I saw a lot of myself in a person who wanted to find things out about the world and had some personal stuff going on too, but nevertheless, like, just kind of that kind of like doing things for the right reasons, trying to get to the bottom of stuff. I think that that showed an interesting presentation of journalism, but I always felt like the cops on that show were very much just trying to, you know, get to the bottom of things and make the world a better place. And obviously how you work within a system that can sometimes be demoralizing, I think is an impressive idea of resilience. Right. And so that one kind of immediately popped to mind as a thing that I genuinely dug. I got to think, you know, like, there's been a lot of like, it was very, very kind of cool to watch some of the evolution of the industry in the past couple of years, and watching stories that seemed like they could not be told all of a sudden get funded for a long time, and kind of get mass audiences and things like that. Even like watching like Call Me By Your Name become like a cultural phenomenon was like, wow, this is a different community. This is a different audience. This is a different world than it was a little while ago.
And Parasite for me.
I mean, Parasite was the happiest I've ever been in a Best Picture like announcement, because that was so shocking and so exciting, and I've been rooting for it. Like, I saw it, like, I must have seen it in like when it came out in September, and I was like, that movie's nuts. I want to think about that movie all the time. And then when it actually started getting buzz, and then when it actually started getting like praise, and then like, it was not favored to win that year, but I was like, I really want this sucker to win. Like, but yeah.
Me too. I was screaming around the room when it won. You can ask my Oscar party. Yeah. was like, you had the realization that this was a big change. This was a major thing.
Yeah. I mean, it just kind of felt like, damn it, good guys win. Like, it was just like, I want the industry to look more like this. And I hope that like, you know, that's the thing that you always kind of hope for when you see the Oscars, which are like, you know, I spent some time predicting them. Everybody has complicated feelings about the Oscars in some regard, because I think that we all recognize that they don't always recognize good stuff. they recognize good stuff often enough that it's worth watching and we're talking about.
Agreed.
But I think that like the best thing that they are is that they give they're a chance for people to basically say like, this is a valuable thing that we'd like to see some more of. And I think that that is a very, very good thing. I grew up at an interesting time in movies. I think that the industry is in a weird place right now. I think that this, the independent stuff is kind of far more vibrant than it's ever been, mostly because I think that it is easier than ever for people to pick up a camera and make something that either allows them to get the next film made or the next film made after that. I think that people are doing cool stuff with smaller budgets now, and I think that that's like, they shouldn't have to, like there should be support for that. But I think that, like, you know, you look at a career like Jordan Peele had, where, you know, I'm going to make a horror movie because I know that horror movies deliver $30 million. You can set your watch to it every time they come out. I'm going to make it for a reasonable budget. And it's also going to be the best movie that you could ever want. And like then parlaying that into a subsequent career, I think is just such a, like, that's the inspiration. You want to see that more and you wish more people had that kind of opportunity, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree. Walt, I'm going to call on you again to talk about the Oscars, which I do a lot on the show.
Oh my God, yeah.
No,
I'd be delighted. So like this year, like, so again, like I predicted the Oscars when I was at 538 just because that was my job.
Yeah.
And then when I left to start the newsletter and start working on this stuff, I was like, I still want to predict the Oscars. And so I made some tweaks to the model. And so again, like it is like the kind of statty based thing, but only as a point to start talking about it, right? Like it basically kind of allows us to kind of get into the minds of how much we should evaluate some of these precursors and whatnot. And this year's wild, right? Because like the Golden Globes changing is, I think, going to be the focus of so much conversation, just because like the question is, what is the worth of this new Ship of Theseus? Anyway, I love this stuff. I can talk about it all day. So please, I would love to come.
Oh, good.
This was so fun. Thank you again for having me. I really had an amazing time.
Don't forget to the listeners, you guys have to catch You Are What You Watch. But what, please tell us, because you have some other great places. Where can they follow you in your newsletter and where can they find it?
No, of course. So again, like the book is called You Are What You Watch. It is out wherever books are sold. You should check it out. It makes a good gift. It's got a lot of charts and like cool, colorful graphics in it. It's a picture book some level. I would highly recommend folks, even if you're intimidated by this stuff, just pick it up. It's a good thing to have. I also do a newsletter. The newsletter is called Numlock News. I started it about 5 years ago when I left 538. It's all about cool numbers in the news. You can find that at numlock.com. And I do an award season newsletter every year that kind of talks about this kind of, you know, 538 style analysis of pop culture stuff. And that can be found at awards.news. That'll get you there. But other than that, I am at Insider as an editor, and I am on Twitter, or X as it were, at Walt Hickey. And if you just Google me, I'm pretty easy to get a hold of.
Well, thank you so much again. This was great.
I mean, pleasure was all mine. I really enjoyed this conversation. We talked about some stuff that I haven't gotten a chance to talk about yet. And again, like, it is just, there's so much fun stuff in there. So thank you again for having me. And thanks so much for your really good questions.
Thank you so much to Walt Hickey. You Are What You Watch is out on October 24th and available for pre-order now. And thank you so much for listening. You can subscribe to Pop Culture Confidential wherever you get your podcasts. Pop Culture Confidential is a part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. See you next time.
You've got questions, we've got answers. Business leadership, ownership, and sales can be challenging. Tune into the Accelerate Your Business Growth podcast to learn from the world's experts. Join me, your host, Diane Helbig, as I chat with people who have expertise in various areas of business. You'll enjoy the lively conversations that are focused on providing you with the ideas, tips, and suggestions you need to realize greater success. Get what you need for your business when you need it from the people who have the answers. Accelerate Your Business Growth is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and is available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.